And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org. We're on iTunes at College Radio as well. Today's Wednesday, August 7th, 2013. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today it's my pleasure to welcome my friend and colleague, Linda Marsa. Linda is an award-winning investigative journalist and a contributing editor at Discover who has covered medicine, health, and science for more than two decades. A former Los Angeles Times reporter, her article, The Future of Water Going to Extremes, was chosen to appear in the Best American Science Writing 2012. She's also written for the Los Angeles Times Magazine, Parade, Pacific Standard, American Archaeology, Mother Jones, Los Angeles, and Playboy. And she's here today to talk about Fevered, Why a Hotter Planet Will Harm Our Health, and How We Can Save Ourselves, just out from Rodale. Hey, Linda.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you on. Let's begin, as we always do, by hearing you talk a little bit about Fevered and how the book came about.
Well, I'm always looking for a book topic, you know, to sort of something that you can really sink your teeth into. And, you know, I've been, like everybody else, I've been reading about climate change and kind of dismayed about what's going on. But I felt, you know, a lot had been written about it. And then I guess this is going back now to 2009. You know, as a medical writer and a science writer, I'm always keeping abreast of the scientific literature. And a report came out in The Lancet, which is this, you know, this kind of esteemed British medical journal. And it talked about how there's an aspect of climate change that nobody's reporting on, which is the public health effects and the effects that climate change is going to have on our health. And I started digging into this, and, you know, obviously medical aspects. As a medical writer, this was really in my wheelhouse. And I thought, wow, this is a way of writing about climate change that no one's really, not much has been written about. So that's really sort of the genesis of the book. And so what I did was, you know, I work for Discover, and I did what ended up becoming a big cover story that ended up actually winning a lot of awards on the rise of vector-borne diseases in a time of changing climate. And, you know, with mosquitoes and ticks and you know, mice are migrating to newly warming habitats, you know, because the climate is changing. And, you know, it really got into it. I was able to sort of immerse myself, and I saw that there was really a book there. So the big article led to a book.
Well, you know, I must say you are such a good writer. This book reminded me a bit style-wise of one of my favorite science books for the lay reader, Life of a Cell by Lewis Thomas.
Oh, and, thank you.
Yeah, in your book, like Thomas's, the writing was a pleasure to read rather than reading it just for the information. And so I am curious how you maintain that. I mean, do you just stick with your voice and you know, it's just a natural at this point? Or did you work in the revision to make it sound more conversational or more like you, or do you not even think about that?
It's funny that you should ask that, because I think that you know, in terms of journalists, I think journalists generally fall into two general categories. You have people who I call are these really great prose stylists. I could just kill them. You know, they write this beautiful stuff and it just pours out of them, and, you know, that's it. And then there's the research grunts. I'm a research grunt. I love to do research. I love to sift through scientific studies. So, I can't even begin to tell you, how thrilled I am that you like my writing, because the writing does not come naturally to me. The writing is something that I have had to work at so hard because I'm not good at it. And I'm very thrilled that you think it came out well. That for me, you know, for me doing the research and, you know, talking to scientists and kind of immersing myself in the literature and, you know, trying to figure out what all this scientific stuff means. I mean, I just did a blog post, you know, for the PLOS on, you know, the migratory patterns of the Aedes albopictus mosquito. I mean, I know, you know, shoot me now, but this is what I do, right? I know, exactly, you know. How did I become such a geek? But the writing is so hard for me. So this isn't just a natural thing. It's because I understand that this is boring stuff. And you have to find a way to make it interesting. And, you know, it gets back to, you know, and I've taken fiction writing classes and I've taken screenwriting classes as a way to figure out how to improve my writing. And, you know, you always come back to character.
Hmm.
You know, and character drives action. So that's what I look for, you know, when I was doing my research. And, you know, interestingly, you know, I've been sort of thinking about it, and I realized that's sort of, I'm going on and on here, but...
No, that's good. It's good to go on this program because it's we're sitting on a big comfy couch talking, and it's just you and me.
Okay. Well, that was the hard part in writing the book, was finding these interesting characters. You know, and you interview a lot of people, but I always look for interesting characters that can somehow drive the action. And you know, when I do research, I always, I don't know if you remember, I don't know if they had it out here. They had it back east where I grew up. They used to have these things called supermarket sweepstakes, and you'd have 5 minutes in the supermarket, and you'd run around, and you'd throw everything you could think of in the basket, you know, and then you'd come home and go, gee, did I really want 10 boxes of pasta? But, you know, but that's sort of like what my writing is. You know, I run around, I collect all this information, and then I come home and I go, all right, what do we got here? How does this all fit together? And some people just don't fit in the story. They're wonderful, they're nice, but it just doesn't fit with the whole arc of the story. So that's basically, you know, sort of what happens. But I'm always looking for a story that provides an arc that you can hang all this other stuff on. I mean, I'm very aware that the migratory patterns of the 80s albopictus mosquito are only interesting to me. But how do I make them interesting to the average reader? Well, how I make them interesting to the average reader is that the Aedes albopictus carries this very odd disease called chikungunya, which is, you know, endemic in Southeast Asia, and it's on its way here because this mosquito is now becoming endemic in the United States, just the same way that West Nile did. And this is all because of global warming, but no one cares about the mosquito. What they care about are the people who are getting sick, what happens to you, et cetera, et cetera.
Hmm. Well, that's, you know, gosh, you just said a lot that I want to jump off from, but I think it's really interesting. We've talked about this before, about character and finding the character that, I mean, I know, you know, you need a story arc and all that, but, it, you know, you keep coming back to character. Could you say a little bit more about that? I mean, you know, if you wanted to write a story about, you know, the mosquito or anything at all, and you didn't have an interesting character, be it, what, a scientist or somebody that's experiencing what you want to talk about? I mean, what would you do? How do you find that right one?
Well, I have to say, and I mean, maybe I'm kind of a brick about this, but I feel the difference. I've always felt this. The difference between a good journalist and a great journalist is...
say again, because something disturbed whatever
yeah,
you said.
I'm sorry. The difference, I think, between a good journalist and a great journalist is one phone call, you know, or is making phone calls. And you just have to keep sticking with it until you find those characters. I mean, that's the real challenge. You know, and that was the mistake I made in writing the book, by the way, is that, you know, I was about halfway through researching the book, and I realized all I've been doing is talking to scientists. I've got to get out there and get my story. I don't have my story. All I've got are these scientists that are all telling me the same thing. I mean, no one cares. I mean, they're nice and they're interesting, and I included them and I wove them into the story. But you've got to have stuff that really grips people, and I feel that you just have to keep looking because they're there. They're there. And the other piece of it is that everybody has a story. Everybody has a great story if you just look hard enough.
You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I am with Linda Marsa. Her new book is called Fevered: Why a Hotter Planet Will Hurt Our Health and How We Can Save Ourselves. With books like yours, it's impossible not to talk about research. So let's talk a little bit about that, because you love the research part, and yet there comes a point where you have to start writing. And so how much research, I mean, you came up with the idea and then you started your research, but how much research did you have to do before you either could write a proposal or could start writing, or both?
Well, you know, I think, well, there's two things on that. The first answer to that question is, it's never enough. There's always something else. I mean, there was a report that came out today from the National Oceanic Administration, you know, on the latest in what's happening with global warming. And, you know, it never ends, the kind of research that you can do. But I will tell a little quick story, and it sort of shows you, you know, at a certain point, you know, you kind of think, you know, this is enough. But George Luber was one of my big sources. He's with the CDC. He's an expert on climate change and how it affects health. And I interviewed Dr. Christopher Poitier, and who had written this huge report for the CDC on all the different aspects of health. And I interviewed him, and then I was talking to George later, and George says, yeah, I was the one who created the notes for him to interview you. And I thought, this is ridiculous. I'm going in a circle now, so I'm getting all the same stuff from people. It's enough already with the scientists. I'm done. So that's one aspect of it, is that at a certain point you start hearing the same things over and over again. So you got the story at that point. But I am kind of a research grunt. That's what I like to do. I just love doing research. I really do. So I tend to over-research.
And then you start writing. I mean, you have to stop the research at some point, right? Or does it just continue as you start writing and you go, you know what, I don't know enough about this. I need to do this, whatever this is.
Right. Well, that happens. You know, the other piece of this is that, you know, deadlines are a really great thing because they really sort of focus the mind. And, you know, what happened was, and I'm sure this happens a lot with a lot of authors, or it happens enough, is that I got the book contract, and then I had some family problems, you know, just my, you know, family things, which you know about. And, you know, I kind of got off. And then my editor left. So I, you know, I was kind of working on the book and, you know, doing my other stuff and this and that. And then a new editor comes in and very rightly says, where's the book? So that kind of focused the mind, and I started writing. And I had a really good idea about what I wanted to do, and I started writing. But you're right, as I'm writing, I realize, well, there's a hole here, there's a hole there. So what you do is you write, and you leave the hole, and then you come back to it. Because, you know, especially at that point, I was on a deadline, and I thought, oh, my God, I've got to, you know, really hop to it, which I did, and I got it in on time. But that's really sort of the process that happens. And I think it happens with everybody.
I'd love to hear you read from Fevered. Would you do that for us?
Oh, sure. Now, how long should this be?
Oh, a few minutes.
Okay. All right, well, what I'd like to, I picked out two selections. So will we have time for two or just one?
Let's do one now, and then we'll do one in the second half.
Okay, well, the first, this is the very, very opening of the book. And I wanted to sort of introduce this a little bit because, you know, the planet has heated up about 2 degrees since the Industrial Revolution. And, you know, we think to ourselves, 2 degrees, what's 2 degrees? What big deal does it make? And this was part of, you know, you asked me about my research. This was sort of part of what really told me that I had a book here, is that I came across this research that was done at NASA, this NASA scientist who was trying to find out what caused the dust bowls. And, you know, it's sort of complicated science, but essentially, there was a 1 degree change in the surface temperatures of the ocean that changed the path of the jet stream. And in changing the path of the jet stream that normally dumps water over the Midwest, they ended up having this drought for 8 or 9 years. And that's what caused the dust bowls. So I sort of opened up, t- talking about the dust bowls and talking about the fact that this is what happens when weather patterns change, that we can have this kind of devastation. So this is what I opened up with.
Okay.
It was the most beautiful day. My husband, Bryce, woke me up before sunup to look at the most beautiful sunrise you ever saw. I was grumpy because it was Sunday morning and we usually slept late on Sunday. But I got up and went out and there were the most beautiful streaks going up from the horizon, way up in the sky, just all colors, just like the northern lights. That's how Bernice Jackson remembered that fateful Palm Sunday in April 1935 in an oral history interview she gave half a century later to the Oklahoma Historical Society. She was a young farm wife then, living with her husband and their four-year-old son, John, in a clapboard two-story house, raising cows, pigs, and chickens, and growing wheat and tomatoes on a hardscrabble patch of the Oklahoma Panhandle. Weeks of relentless dust storms, almost 50 in the previous month, had howled across a parched landscape, baked by years of drought and record-breaking heat that often soared into the triple digits. These storms had already blown out 5 million acres of farmland and destroyed most of the wheat crop in Kansas, Nebraska, and Oklahoma. Parts of Kansas had seen barely a dust-free dozen days since the start of the year, and some areas had suffered dust storms every single day in March. But suddenly, on that cloudless morning, the wind stopped, and an eerie stillness settled into the air. The day dawned sunny and clear, with seemingly endless blue skies and temperatures that climbed into the mid-80s by early afternoon. Bryce, Bernice told her husband, maybe that's an omen that our dust storms are over, and it's going to rain.
Excellent. Thank you so much. That was Linda Marsa reading from Fevered, Why a Hotter Planet Will Hurt Our Health and How We Can Save Ourselves, just out from Rodale. Earlier you said, how did I become such a geek? And so I want to talk about that because, you know, you were an LA Times reporter for quite a bit and quite a long time. And I wonder what you focused on there. And I think I recall pharmaceuticals, but you could talk a bit about that and how that kind of, you know, segued into writing about the environment.
Well, I was a medical writer, and my beat was kind of the pharmaceutical industry, and you have to be kind of a geek to write about that too, because I wrote a lot about drug discovery, and you know, to sort of back up, really back up. I was an English major in college, and I practically failed high school chemistry. I got a D in high school chemistry. But then when I was early in my career, you know, a very good friend of mine became an editor at Omni, and she kind of pulled me into writing at Omni, and I fell in love with science writing. It was just so interesting. You know, it's like finding this whole part of yourself that you never knew existed, you know, which is why I always really encourage people to try different kinds of things, because you never know. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, if somebody had told me when I was in college that I was going to become a science journalist, I would have told them they were out of their mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
In fact, I remember when my friend first said to me, look, we really need you to do this story. It was on genetics. I said, you called the wrong Linda. Are you sure you have the right? She says, no, we really need it, and I know you won't miss a deadline, you know. And she said, and I'll never forget what she said. She said, this will open up a whole new career for you. And it did. And I actually dedicated the book to her, the editor that helped me in this way. But what happened was with the pharmaceutical stuff, I had been writing about that for about 20 years. I had done a book on it, and I had covered that when I was at the Times, and I had really kind of gotten burned out on it because it really was always the same story. You know, they're pushing some drug, they're creating these diseases for the drug to treat, and, you know, really people are taking all these drugs they don't really need, and they're having terrible side effects from them. You know, just fill in the blank what the drug was. And it was becoming not interesting to me anymore. And I also felt that there was a lot of people that were covering it very well. They didn't really need me. And I thought, what can I do that would be intellectually satisfying to me that's a really important story? And I realized that I think climate change is probably the most important science story of our generation. But so much had been written about climate change. What was I going to write that was new? And then I saw this story about how it was going to affect our health. So this fell right in my wheelhouse.
Well, what's the crossover from being a journalist at the LA Times and writing books?
Well, the thing is, before I was at the Times, so I was a magazine writer, and then I was at the Times, and then I went back to doing, you know, magazine freelancing because, you know, being a newspaper reporter is so different from being a magazine reporter. I'm really sorry, Barbara. You know, it's 9 o'clock in the morning, and everybody wants to get a hold of me. Ringing here, but it's different from being, and magazine writing is very different from books. So it was difficult. You know, it was difficult making that transition. It was less of a transition going from, say, the Times and then, you know, going back to magazine writing. But, you know, to go from magazine writing to writing a book, it was hard, you know, because you have to, you know, a book is this mammoth project that lasts a long time. You get really sick of it after a while, you know, and you think, is anybody going to read this? But also, you know, you have this huge arc, you know, to make sure, because a lot of times you'll get into something and you think, is this just a long magazine piece? Is there really a book here? So that I think is a real big difference. But the one thing that was really helpful to me is that when I did do magazine work, I tend to do what's called long form. You know, I'd write 4,000 or 5,000 word stories. So, you know, those are almost book chapters. So that's helpful.
Yeah, that's interesting. And when we come back after the break, I want to talk a little bit about writing long form for magazines. But regarding the segment you read, opening with Bernice, how did you find her, and why did you decide to open the book with her?
Well, it's mainly, well, first of all, again, I wanted to have a character, you know, and from there, I didn't realize how long that section was, because there was a whole section talking about, you know, after that section. The reason that I picked her, and I didn't get into it, is that this was sort of an opening to the worst dust storm in history, you know, which happened on that day. And what I wanted to bring out, you know, obviously you want to open a book with this most dramatic story you could think of. And that was very dramatic. And the point that I was making here is sort of what I alluded to before, is what I found in my research is what I'm trying to drive home with this book is that even a 1 degree change in temperature changes our ecosystems in ways that have just far-reaching consequences, because we've only had a 2 degree change since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, but you can already see all the change. I mean, we're living in a much hotter planet than we did when I grew up. There's just no question to me. Mm-hmm. I can just see it, and everybody else can too. And that was why I picked that.
Well, we're going to take a very short break, so everybody out there, stay with us. We're going to be right back with more Linda Marsa in just a minute, so don't go anywhere.
San Francisco, are you ready? Stern Grove, are you ready? It's a very special occasion this year as Stern Grove is celebrating its 75th anniversary. And who better to celebrate this event with than a gentleman who has graced us with almost as many years of inspiring music. He's here in the Grove with his whole family today, and we're thrilled to have him. Please welcome the amazing Pete Escovedo and his orchestra. Go ahead, Pops.
What's up, San Francisco? Are you ready to have a good time? We're so excited to be here. Hey, we're going to do some Latin jazz stuff. Is that cool? All right, here we go.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. And I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I've been here since the top of the hour with Linda Marsa. Her book is Fevered, Why a Hotter Planet Will Hurt Our Health and How We Can Save Ourselves, published by Rodale. Hey, Linda.
Hi, Barbara.
I was trying to find the part in the book that I read that talked about living in cities, and I couldn't find it. But, you know, the more I read, and in reading your book, I am beginning to be convinced that living in cities, as opposed to even the country or the suburbs, is actually easier on the ecosystem. And in your book, you talked about the High Line in Manhattan and what they've done to transform an abandoned railroad track to create this beautiful outdoor garden. So could you talk a little bit about that? Some of the things you found that kind of makes your book not a doom and gloom type of book, but also sort of a ray of hope as to good things happening that could turn the situation around.
Okay, well, there's several things. Let me just sort of put the thing about the city aside for a second, because that's a very important issue. But, you know, sort of generally, you know, so if I could just make some general remarks. You know, when I first started writing the book, this is 09, so this is 4 years ago almost, no one was talking about climate change. So I was in, you know, and then I'm talking to scientists, they're all terrified, you know, all these projections, you know, the world is going to end tomorrow. And I was very depressed. But then I really sort of drilled down. And, you know, if you get away from all the nonsense that's going on in Washington, people at a local level, this one, you know, administrator, this one, you know, city administrator said, nobody has to tell me about climate change. All I have to do is look out the window. And this is what I found, that at a local level, you know, the mayors across the country take climate change very seriously, and they're looking forward to what's going to be happening to their different cities. And they are, you know, we're beyond the early adopter stage in a lot of these programs. I mean, a lot of programs have been implemented across the country to keep cities viable and adapt to a changing climate. But, you know, we're beyond the pilot program stage. They've already made the mistakes. These are all, you know, to use an overused cliche, shovel-ready projects that can be adopted across the country that can help us adapt to a changing climate. And, you know, I do want to talk about the cities thing because that's really important, but Orange County, California, and everybody laughs when I say this. They think I'm kidding, but I'm not. Orange County, California is one of the world leaders in water management. And, you know, I've met with the people down there. I have a whole section in the book on them. And it's really quite wonderful because they looked, and I was just at a water summit about a month or so ago. And, you know, it was at the Disneyland Hotel. This is the heartland. You know, the Orange County tends to be much more conservative than the rest of, you know, California. But, you know, no one was sitting there questioning whether climate change is happening. They were talking about what they're going to do in terms of water management in a changing climate. And they've come up with, Orange County has come up with some really wonderful plans. And I saw that all over the country. You know, Los Angeles is doing Beyond Coal. They're going to be coal-free by 2020. And everywhere I looked, there were programs that were being implemented where people were looking up in Seattle. You know, we're going to have rising sea levels. What do we need to do about that? Mayor Michael Bloomberg has just been, he's a world leader in being a steward of the earth. And he is really trying to get New York ready for climate change. So there's all these things going on. To answer, to move to the thing about the cities, this is something that surprised me. I never, you know, I grew up in New York, and I always thought of it as kind of this dirty, kind of grungy place. But places like New York are really the future because, you know, you can live in a very concentrated way. I mean, New Yorkers' carbon footprint is smaller than any, you know, than the carbon footprint of anybody, especially people living out in the country. You think out in the country it's all bucolic and you're not wasting and this and that and the other thing. But you use a lot of energy driving around, and you know, in cities, people are, it's much more denser living, people walk, and really cities are healthier places to live because people walk, they're not stuck in their cars, there's much more of a community. I was very struck by that because I go to New York a couple times a year and I stay with this friend of mine who lives in the West Village. And it hit me that I knew the people in her building better than I know my neighbors.
Mm-hmm. I love that part of your book.
It just really struck me. I mean, I don't know my neighbors at all, but I know the super. I watched his kid grow up. I know the kid. You know, it's really, it was just incredible to me. And I saw that. I mean, just Julianne Moore lives in her neighborhood. Mm-hmm. The actress. I know her to say hello to her. I mean, not that just because I see her on the street, you know, and she's a nice person. I mean, this is the kind of difference, you know, that I saw. And cities, really, the majority of people on the planet are going to be living in cities, and I think cities are going to be a vehicle to move towards a greener future.
Mm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Linda Marsa. Her book is Fevered by Rodel, and I would love to hear you read again.
Oh, okay. Well, the other section, you know, I'm always trying to find dramatic stories. And, you know, you asked me about, you know, why I picked the Bernice story. I'm trying to find people that are just regular, normal people that people can relate to so that people understand that this could happen to them. I spent about a month down in Australia because, for a lot of reasons, a lot of science reasons. I won't bother you with all my nerdy stuff, but for a lot of, you know, geeky reasons, Australia's on the front lines of climate change, and they've always had very erratic weather, but it's really sort of ratcheted up by several orders of magnitude. And just very quickly, they're surrounded by three oceans, so they're at the mercy of all the different ocean currents. And then they're basically a big flat desert island, so that they don't have any of the typography that sort of, you know, changes weather. So in any event, I was down there right after the floods that they had in 2011, which sort of flooded half the country. And I opened with a story about a boy who died in the floods. Jordan Rice was an unlikely hero, barely 13, with tousled strawberry blonde hair and inquisitive blue eyes. He was a shy, quiet eighth grader in a comfortably middle-class family. But the teenager's bravery on a warm summer day in 2000, in the midst of possibly the worst floods in Australian history, transformed him into a national symbol of courage and hope for the victims of the disaster. He lived with his parents and three brothers in Toowoomba, Queensland, a farming community about 80 miles inland from Australia's east coast that sits on the crest of the Great Dividing Range, the string of mountains that separates the coastal lowlands from the rich soil and abundant grasslands of the agricultural heartlands. I'm skipping.
Okay.
Ahead. They had severe water restrictions had been in place in the city for years because of a long drought, and the city, in an act of desperation, hoped a state-sponsored cloud seeding experiment would end the long dry spell. Yet when the rains finally did come, they did nothing to ease the drought. Months of torrential spring storms that began in November 2010 and continued through the Australian summer drenched vast stretches of Queensland. There had been a welcome break in the weather, and it was hardly raining that afternoon in January when Donna Rice, Jordan's 43-year-old mother, decided to venture out with Jordan and his 10-year-old brother, Blake. But unexpectedly, the skies opened up, and a cloudburst from a freak storm sent a raging torrent of water through the Lockyer Valley. Engulfed by the rising flood waters, Rice's white Mercedes stalled at a busy intersection. Frantic, she called the emergency dispatch, which was overwhelmed with other calls. When the operator finally came on the line, she instructed Rice to climb onto the roof of her car with the two boys and wait. A Good Samaritan truck driver arrived on the scene, tied a rope around his waist, and jumped into the raging torrent. He reached for the older boy, but Jordan refused to go first, even though he couldn't swim and was terrified of the deep water. "Save me, brother," he pleaded. Blake, his younger brother, was whisked to safety, but before the driver could return to rescue Jordan and Donna, they were swept away by the floodwaters and drowned. Anyway, you know, and then it's sort of a lead-in to what happens. But, you know, I try and personalize everything that happens with people's stories because they sort of symbolize, you know, what happens. I mean, you know, I went to New Orleans about a year ago to because their public health system was completely decimated by Katrina. And, you know, and we saw what happened with Katrina, but we didn't see what happened with the aftermath. And I went there, you know, as I said, a year ago, and this was 7 years after Katrina, And the public health system still hadn't been rebuilt, and people were still devastated from it. So, and I focused on that. And they were regular, normal. I mean, this one woman was an ER nurse. I mean, this isn't like these people are impoverished or without resources. These are just regular people like us.
And before I forget, I want to give everyone your website, which is lindamarsa.com. I love some of the pictures on your website. I love the one of you with the lemur. That's adorable. But also, you were talking about being in Orange County and what Orange County's doing with water, and you're on your website drinking water from a reclamation site, yes?
Yeah, I'm happily, I have my little hard hat on, and I have this big grin, and I'm drinking sewage.
You do look quite, you do have a curious look on your face, though. You're like, am I really doing this? Is it really okay? But you're doing it.
You know, I mean, I really do have, like, this great job. I mean, every now and then I think about what a great job I have. Because, you know, when I was in Australia, I went to the Daintree Rainforest, which is the oldest, most ancient rainforest in the world. And I was given sort of a tour of the research facility they have up there. And at one point, I had to climb up this industrial crane, you know, to sort of get a look from an overview, which is fabulous, but it's 200 feet. And I am, as you know, Barbara, no spring chicken. And I thought, do I really want to do this? But it's my job, you know. So I get to do all that. I mean, last week I went on an archaeological dig. You know, I had to get up at 5 in the morning and go out to Catalina, but I got to see parts of Catalina that nobody ever gets to see. But anyway, so water reclamation. Well, what Orange County's doing, in addition to a whole suite of strategies that they've employed, but the thing that they really are doing that I think is really incredible is that they have what's called toilet to tap, and they take toilet water, you know, the time you flush, and they clean it up, and they make it so that it's drinkable. And that's what I'm drinking on the website, is the stuff that just has come out of the pipes and it's clean. And I think something like 20% of Orange County's water that comes out of the tap is this reclaimed water. And I did a lot of research on this, you know, because, you know, the problem with science writing is that there's always somebody out there that knows that you've made a mistake, so you just have to be so careful. So that's the one downside, is that you've really got to know your stuff and really immerse yourself. And I really sort of came to the conclusion that there's a lot of problems with desalination, and I'm not sure that that's going to be a viable alternative for us right now. You know, they really need to improve the technology for a variety of reasons. But what I really felt like was this toilet to tap is really the answer. And what Orange County did that other places haven't been able to do is they did this incredible community outreach, so they brought the community along with them so that there wasn't a lot of community opposition to this, which has sort of doomed other projects of this nature in other places.
Interesting. Well, there's a lot to talk about still, and I want to get to it all, but I know we're not going to. So let me go through my notes here. And you know, you talked earlier about finding the character, and we've talked a bunch about writing query letters that you know, will get an editor's attention at a magazine. And I think with science, well, I don't know. I'm thinking with science type articles, the query needs to be probably more in depth than, say, a light, fluffy piece for a woman's magazine. I don't know. I mean, that may not be true, but will you talk a little bit about, first of all, writing for magazines, and if the whole situation depresses you like it depresses so many, and if you think writing for science or technology is a better way to go if you are interested in writing for magazines, and then thirdly, the query letter, And again, writing, you know, in-depth query letters that get somebody's attention, all that. Could you comment
sure.
on any of that?
Sure. Well, I think that, okay, so just to answer the easiest question first, I do think that there's a tremendous market for good science writing, you know, and it's not just, you know, say, Discover and places like that, but, you know, just general interest publications, if you have that background in terms of science and medicine, because it is difficult, and there aren't that many people who do it well and have that kind of scientific rigor. So if you are interested, I would encourage you to do it. It's hard. It's really complicated. And sometimes I think, why am I doing this? But it interests me. And that's the bottom line. It really does genuinely interest me. So I'm willing to puzzle all that stuff out. As far as the depression in the magazine world, I don't know what to say about that. You know, I'm hustling too. I mean, I thought at this point in my career I'd be established and I wouldn't be killing myself, and I'm working harder than I've ever worked in my life. So I don't know what to say about that. But I have to say, you know, sort of parenthetically and a little quickie, mm-hmm. I'm actually very cheered by Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post,
mm-hmm.
and Michael Bloomberg is talking about buying the New York Times. I think maybe this will be good things,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I was at the Times when the Tribune bought the Times, and I watched it happen. I watched that corporatization happen. You know, where it suddenly became very conservative and they weren't willing to, you know, take as many chances and risks, and there was a lot of, you know, fanny covering and things like that. And I think maybe this might be a good development because Bloomberg and Bezos don't have to answer to shareholders. They
mm-hmm.
just do what they want,
mm-hmm.
you know, and maybe it'll be good journalism. And Bloomberg, you know, he's not perfect, but he's done a lot of really good things. So we'll see. So we'll see. But as far as journalism goes, you know, the model's changing. You know, it really is. So, I mean, I'm not see in you know, 10 or 15 years. So I think that right now we're going through this transition. But the other piece of it is that there's still a tremendous market for long-form journalism. And if you know how to do long-form journalism, I think that, you know, you'll be able to find work. And as far as, you know, long form goes or writing queries, you've got to find your story. And you have to have that story, whether it's science or not. And as far as the science stuff goes, the hard part about writing science is finding a hook that is fresh and new and interesting. And that's really tricky because if you don't really know the subject, you're not going to know what's new and fresh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might be going over stuff that's not. But stepping back, you know, the science is very interesting, but you have to find a story. I'm doing a story right now, a neuroscience story,
mm-hmm.
on, you know, gender differences in the brain. And this is really a very new way of looking about how hormones reshape the brain and stuff like that. But I mean, you know, gag me with a spoon. I mean, it's really, you know, I mean, this stuff. I mean, you know, talk about being a geek. How do I make this interesting?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm using one scientist as sort of a through line and then weaving in all the other research around that particular scientist who's actually kind of an interesting guy.
So if somebody listening, if a writer listening wants to get involved in science writing or long-form journalism, what would you suggest?
Okay, I would suggest two things. As far as getting involved in science writing, I would get your feet wet with, you know, maybe something that you know that's interesting that has maybe a science bent to it. Now, one caveat is I have sort of, you know, I've learned neuroscience. I'm interested in that. You know, I've learned stuff about biotechnology, drug development, and I did learn the environmental stuff. Some of that stuff was harder than others, but some areas I ventured into, my brain just could never, there was never any fertile cells that, you know, I mean, I did a physics story several years back for the LA Times magazine that was a disaster because I never really got it and, you know, it just didn't work, et cetera, et cetera. So if you want to get your feet wet, you know, pick something that you think, you know, you think you'd be interested in. That would be the first step. as far as long form goes, there's a really very specific structure for long form journalism, and I think that you really need to take some classes in that, you know, to sort of learn basic structure. And then, you know, what I do a lot is, you know, I read the New Yorker, I read the New York Times Magazine, you know, things like that. I deconstruct, you know, I'll look at a story that I think is really well done, and I will deconstruct in my mind, mm-hmm. you know, as a learning process, how they did it.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting way of studying, too. I've been doing that lately with memoir. Because,
right.
You know, like, how are these written? And if you study enough of them, you see the ones that work and why they work. And the ones that aren't working, you can see that, too.
Right. Exactly.
Hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So, you belong to ASJA, as I do, and that's where we met. What does belonging to ASJA and other types of writers' organizations do for you in a practical sense? Because I'll talk to writers that don't really belong to any organization and feel that, you know, why would I want to? Why would I want to pay those dues and do that when really what I want to do is write and not network?
Well, I have to say I belong to four organizations now. And I'm active in two of them. I'm very active in ASJA with you, and then I'm also somewhat active in the Association of Healthcare Journalists, and I belong to the Society of Environmental Journalists, which I just joined, and then I also belong to the National Association of Science Writers, which I'm not that active in. I just judged a contest for them and stuff. There's several things. The networking, you have to be part of the writing community. I I'm really an introvert. I know everybody laughs when I tell them that, but I really am. I mean, I like to be all alone in my room and just work and leave me alone. But you have to, I really think you've got to be part of the writing community. For a couple reasons. Number one, just for your own sanity, for the incredible support that you get. I mean, just sort of, you know, pulling back, I can't even begin to tell you, in terms of promoting the book, how much all my ASJA buddies have helped. You, Caitlin Kelly, Sandy Lamb, on and on and on and on. So many of the people I've met through ASJA and the Association of Healthcare Journalists just really helped me promote the book and also, you know, keep me sane. But the other piece of this is, and you know how I feel very strongly about this, Barbara, is that our profession is really under siege. And we have got to really work together and stick together and support each other. And I think that the way to do it is through a lot of these organizations.
Mm. Well, we're at the end of our time, and I wonder if, in closing, you could just, you know, give our listeners a little tidbit of, you know, writing yourself out of something that's not working, or any advice that you've gleaned along the way that you've carried with you.
Well, it gets back to what I said earlier about making the extra phone call.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if something's not working, either it's not working, you know, and it's funny because I have a story right now that there's a problem with, and I'm working with the editors, you know, and I think you have to honestly be able to say that, because a lot of times we get these assignments and we think there's something wrong with us if we're not finding it, but you should, you know, work with the editors, say, look, this isn't working, what can we do with it? But the other piece of that is that I think that you can always find the story, but it may take a little bit more work, and I think that we have to be willing to take that extra step, make that extra phone call, do that extra bit of work.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for being here for the entire hour with me, Linda.
Oh, well, thank you, Barbara. This was fun.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun, and I just wish you great good luck with this book.
All right. Thank you, Barbara.
You're welcome. That was Linda Marsa. Her book is Fevered, Why a Hotter Planet Will Hurt Our Health and How We Can Save Ourselves, published by Rodale. And you can find more at her website, lindamarsa.com. And she's on Facebook and all over the place. So check out the book. It's wonderfully written with all kinds of excellent information. And it's not a doom and gloom text either. It's wonderful. Anyway, we're at the end of our time. You've been listening to Writers on Writing, and this is KUCI FM in Irvine. Come back next week. Who's going to be on next week? Jenny Milchman with Cover of Snow, a novel. Talk to you all very, very soon.